Radio City, John Grayson and Rob Ross with you once again this week, talking a little bit about what's going on in the pop culture world. And Rob Ross, how's everything going with you?
So far, so good, my friend. How are you this week?
Outstanding. It's been a good week. You got to go out a little while, and the weather has turned beautiful, so it kind of begs for that, spending some time outside the house, which is nice. And I'll tell you, I grew a brand new appreciation for having the windows down and the music cranked in the car.
You know, today it was surprisingly hot. I mean, it's 91 degrees in New York, and it was a very strange week because every day was a jacket and an umbrella. You know, the closest we got to, you know, steady sunshine was probably Friday, and even then a jacket was necessary in the morning, but we went right from a really delightful spring into just immediate summer. I still don't have the air conditioners in the windows yet, which is kind of nice. You know, I've been able to buy some time, so maybe next weekend, since it is the pre-official summer weekend, but so far so good.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, that's funny because that's something I miss. When I was a kid, that idea of putting the air conditioners in the windows, when I was a kid, we had those because there was no central air in Buffalo. Why in God's name would you do that? So I spent a lot of time as a kid in spring and in fall with the windows in my room open. And I kind of miss going to sleep with the sounds of town outside, you know, hearing cars go by, hearing people talking out on back porches. And there was something great about that, even hearing the occasional siren go off at the fire station down the block.
Well, that's just, you know, the sounds of our youth. Yeah. It was the same for me. Growing up in the deepest part of the Staten Island suburbs, we had that. And, you know, the other thing was, you always knew summer was coming the minute it was time to put the air conditioners in.
Right.
And then you got a little bit, you know, weepy at the fact that they were coming out, which meant fall was on its way, and that meant back to school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, you could really tell time by the sounds that were going on outside when you were going to sleep. And, of course, how light it was or how dark it was. So, yeah, the old days, so you miss a little bit of that. And I also miss a little bit of that because the news was a lot easier to parse in those days. But it's funny because there's a lot of echoes of that. When I was five, I remember watching a lot of the not the hearings so much, but a lot of what was going on in the breakdown of Watergate as all of that was happening. And now here we are, and it's that same kind of situation, but with the addition of the 24-hour news cycle. And I'll tell you, the burnout factor is just running hot and heavy right now.
And the worst part going along with that train of thought is that we're only 6 months into this.
Yeah.
That's very off-putting. You know, how much longer can anybody, and I'm not just talking about people involved directly in politics, but how much more as a society can we sustain? You know, we've also been over inundated by what's going on in England. And I hate to say this, but we can't really worry about what's going on in England by virtue of the fact that we need to worry about what's happening right here under our own noses.
Right.
We need to look at what has to be done, because this whole thing, this whole week between Trump and Comey has just been, I think we've already passed surrealism now.
Yeah.
It's there aren't really the right words, because to my best recollection, there's never been anything like this.
No, and the fascinating thing to watch now is that the Republican senators who were on that panel are starting to give interviews to the press about James Comey's testimony and their reaction to it. And what they've been saying, almost all of them, is effectively, the president has to stop acting like a child. This business about, oh, you'll find out soon enough whether there's recordings and all of that. I mean, just cut this bullshit out and let's lay our cards out on the table. And of course, he won't do that because he likes playing this game. But, you know, on the other side of that, the fact that these are Republican senators who are already calling him out for that, they're sick of it. They want this over with and they want something done. And if he's already lost them, this is not going to be an easy go for him, and it's not going to go away anytime soon.
The thing is that there aren't enough of them yet out there,
right,
raising the hue and cry that needs to be raised.
You know, you take action, yeah.
And you need to get your own majority to have a majority.
Right.
And to be behind the notion of, you either get up and testify and come clean, or we are in fact going to find a way to get you out. It has to go one way or the other. It can't just keep plodding along somewhere in the middle where he's allowed to keep doing what he's going to do. Well, I'm going to roll back this and I'm going to do that. No, don't give him any more opportunity to cause any more damage.
Right. And what we've heard for the last couple of months about the guys in the inner circle is, well, he's been alternately fighting with one or the other of them. And he was fighting with Steve Bannon for a while, and he was fighting with Reince Priebus for a while, and now he's fighting with Jeff Sessions. But the fact is, they're all still there. And I wonder how much of this we're being fed is being leaked from the White House on purpose, whether any of it's real, these supposed rifts and rows that are going on with his inner circle. I think it's all bullshit.
Well, I agree with you, and you said exactly what I was about to say. The fact that they're all still there is the big problem. So to me, it's just a big old smoke screen.
Yeah.
And the fact is, Trump has this insatiable, compulsive need for any kind of attention, good, bad, or indifferent. Well, no, not indifferent. He doesn't like indifference.
Yeah,
He
right.
loves praise, and it amps him up even further when he gets really worked up because somebody said something negative about him. I mean, he has got dictator written all over him, and the fact that nobody really sees this, and I'm talking about on the Republican side now,
Yeah.
because certainly, even though I don't love the left, they are absolutely correct in saying he's a dictator, but the right should be equally worried.
Yeah, and it's going to take him doing something, taking some kind of action that really hurts the Republican Party. And he's come close to doing it before. But the minute that he does that, the minute they start to get the idea that he's going to cost them votes in the election that's going to take place in 2018, that's when you're going to see things start to shift dramatically because, well, like the great Mel Brooks said, we've got to protect our phony baloney jobs, gentlemen.
Well, the thing is that at the end of the day, it's the voters
Yep.
who will make the difference. And for those who claim, and I'm using the word claim in quotation marks here, that they know that Trump is completely and utterly full of shit, they have to prove themselves in their polling places.
Right. Right. And there were a couple of other things that happened on the political scene this week that I thought were of particular interest. And one of them is the fact that the state of Kansas almost never makes headlines. And this week it did. And it did for all the right reasons, which is kind of a rarity. And for folks who are not aware of what's been going on, you really probably should be, because for the past, oh, I don't know how many years, 10 plus, the governor of Kansas, Sam Brownback, has been effectively destroying the state. He's run it into the ground financially because he is about the most conservative when it comes to fiscal matters politician in the country. He took that idea of Reagan's trickle down, what George Herbert Walker Bush rightly described as voodoo economics, and took it to the extreme, cut taxes to the bone, cut spending to the bone, and then kept going. And it finally got to the point after all this time where the voters in the state of Kansas were screaming and saying, look, something has got to happen here. And the matters got so bad that they were looking at a public school system that was not going to be able to open its doors come the fall in the state of Kansas. And the state legislature finally, after all this time, decided to send a budget to Sam Brownback, which he vetoed, and it was effectively funding the state and raising taxes. And so Brownback vetoed it, and they overrode his veto. A Republican legislature in the state of Kansas overrode the governor's veto and told him, stick it up your ass. We're going to do this anyway because people have to have things and they need to be paid for.
Well, chalk one up for a sense of right against wrong,
Right.
yeah, especially in something as dirty as current politics. I mean, we're going to have coming up in November a mayoral election, and I can honestly say that having voted for Bill de Blasio, I am one who will vote for anybody but in this upcoming campaign. I definitely think we were sold a bill of goods, completely inept. He definitely talks out of both sides of his mouth. And the fact that he has always taken a very antagonistic approach towards Staten Island from the get-go, because Staten Island was the only one of the five boroughs who didn't vote for him, it makes me want to see him out of office. And, as everyone is aware, I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I certainly wouldn't vote for him. He has handled things so poorly, whether it's the police, because they've had their numerous clashes, or him being the only one seemingly who wouldn't stand against a convicted terrorist marching in a parade. It's just a very embarrassing state of affairs here. Nothing as severe as having a budget debate between your governor and the body of the state, but still, right, it affects us greatly right here in New York. I mean, just to give you a very quick glimpse, he became mayor in January 2014, and immediately upon taking the oath of office, we were hit with a huge snowstorm. And sure enough, Staten Island, parts of Brooklyn, and parts of Queens had no snow shoveling so that people could be dug out of streets. There were several deaths because ambulances couldn't reach people. And he fobbed it off, you know, in a half-assed manner of defending the Department of Sanitation and basically saying, you know, it takes time. No, you knew that this snowstorm was coming. Right. You should have been at the ready. You know, it's just that kind of thing that has made life in New York City very uncomfortable. And he's always talking about a greener city, but he demands to be driven everywhere by an SUV, whether it's from his, whether it's from Gracie Mansion to his workout in the morning, or, you know, and also he's the one who instilled a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit on certain suburban areas. Certainly there's a lot of it here in Staten Island. But meanwhile, his entourage speeds along, and it just the hypocrisy is an amazing thing. But there you go. Left or right, politics at this moment is more fucked up than I can ever remember. And yeah. I'm talking about a memory that spans back to watching as a 9-year-old the Watergate hearings.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, there seems to be a lack of flexibility, and that's actually not the right word to use, but what I'm talking about is there's a lack of the ability to have government react in a timely manner really to anything. And it's getting to the point now. I mean, we've seen these town hall meetings with senators and congresspeople around the country for the last year or two where they've been getting screamed at by the people who, as many of whom voted for them and are the reason that they're in office in the first place. And their reaction has been defensive, and it's been there's no action taking place. There's no sense of urgency to fix anything. And what you talked about with the reaction to the snowstorm, that's a microcosm of that, because you have government reacting in an emergency situation in a very lackluster, lacking any sense of urgency kind of way. And it just seems like the last thing they want to do is react to the immediate needs of their constituents. And I thought that's what a representative republic was supposed to be based on.
Well, you know, something, you bring up a really good point, because, you know, in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, you know, New York had this thing called the Build It Back program. And certainly the people of the Rockaways and on Staten Island, and I can't speak for Queens, but I can certainly speak for the stories that I've heard on Staten Island. You want to talk about a failed government agency. And I mean failed. There are an X amount of people now who had signed on for Buy It Back rather than – I'm sorry, Build It Back rather than be bought out and move elsewhere. They agreed to the terms, and now the New York government is saying, well, we can't afford it. Sorry. Is there a way to describe this accurately? I don't think so, but there you go. They didn't respond in a timely enough manner, and the onus is really on the Bloomberg administration, the previous mayorship, because – they really thought it was going to be less severe than it actually was.
Right.
We're talking about the fact that right now, when you come out of the Staten Island Ferry on the Manhattan side, there was a brand new subway station built for the number one train, because that's the starting point of the line. And that station has still been closed since Hurricane Sandy. They had to reopen the old version of the station, which is smaller, crowded, et cetera, et cetera. The new one still hasn't been repaired. Meanwhile, the Hoboken Path Station was cleaned out and reopened within 3 months of Sandy.
Yeah.
This is how New York has not responded. But the Build It Back program is an abhorrent thing, because there are people now left in limbo waiting for their houses to either be completed of being raised above a substantial level so that way there's less to no chance of flooding should this, God forbid, happen again, to – still being where they were because the money's not there.
Yeah.
And this lack of care, just basic human care, is what really angers me beyond words.
Well, let's get a little happy then, because there are things that have been going on that are much better. And I'll tell you, the Stanley Cup Finals, and we talked a little bit about this the last time we were going over this, has not, I mean, it has not disappointed, I don't think, in any way. The only thing I think that was interesting to watch is over the last couple of games, and we're headed into, as we talk about this, we're just a couple of hours away from Game 6 taking place in Nashville, and the home team has won every game. For the last couple, they've won it really convincingly. But the one thing that I think, that if you wanted to just step back and say, is there anything really failing, really lacking in these games? It's, yeah, the officiating is miserable. It's so bad. And it got to the point, I think, early in Game 5 where it really did affect the outcome of the game. Granted, it was a blowout of a game in the end, but when that momentum is going and you have things that are blatant penalties that are not getting called, there's no stopping that train. It takes away the ability of the other team to try to get back into it, which is their job at that point.
Well, go back to Game 1.
Yeah.
When Superman scored the first goal and then it was waved off. It was a good goal.
Yep.
End of story. The officiating in the NHL has gone downhill steadily over the last, I'd say, 3-4 years without fail. You watch regular season games and you're sitting there scratching your head going, what the fuck? You know, the Rangers, and I don't think I'm being biased here. It's just, you know, I watch the Rangers, obviously, because they're my team.
Mm-hmm.
You see these very questionable calls, or more often than not, non-calls on blatant penalties. You know, a guy from the Rangers will get called for supposed tripping when you can see that the opponent took a dive, but the Rangers will get called for an offsides that wasn't. That is just so commonplace, and it really does take you out of the game. It takes the wind out of the sails, and it makes you say, what am I watching this for?
Right, and in the last game, the one that really, I mean, there were a couple of obvious tripping calls that went uncalled, but when Sidney Crosby is laying on top of Subban behind Nashville's net, and for a good 25, 30 seconds just smashing his head into the ice, there's a referee standing next to them and doesn't make the call, doesn't even look over to see what's going on, there's a problem.
I've noticed that Crosby seems to have a hard-on for Subban in this playoff.
Yep.
Now, I don't know what his problem is. As a fan of the Rangers, of course, I hated Subban because he was with the Canadiens.
Right.
And
yep.
Always played so well against them. But, you know, after seeing his backstory and what an incredibly good person he is, I'm actually a fan. The things he'd done for the kids up in Montreal, I can't commend him enough about what a genuinely fine young man he is. Never mind the fact that he's just a great hockey player.
Yep.
And certainly Nashville has taken him to heart and he to them. I don't know what Crosby's problem is. Maybe because people don't like Crosby because he's always been a whiner and a complainer. You know, let's face it. You know, he's a big guy. He likes to hit. But if you hit him back, no.
Right.
That's what they always call him, Crosbaby. I mean, for fuck's sake,
yeah.
Man ups.
And it seems like there's always one of those guys on the Penguins. Who was it? With the hockey hair, about 10 years ago. Which one?
Yager?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, he was.
That seemed to give as good as he got. You know, he didn't seem too pissy to me.
Yeah.
Actually, no. You know, go back further 10 years because 10 years ago he was with the Rangers.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it wasn't him then. There was somebody that showed up at one point trying to make a joke out of the whole thing in the Pens locker room wearing a little girl Halloween mask. And I was like, well, that's kind of cute, but still, it shows that there's still somebody out there who's just whining and complaining about everything. So, and what are you going to do? But either way, I mean, the level of play has been outstanding.
It's been exciting. And I got to tell you, I hope it's been good for the ratings.
Yes.
Because that's the problem. I mean, it's nice to see that the finals are actually on NBC rather than relegated to, you know, the NBC Sports Network.
Right. Yeah, they finally put a couple. I think the first few games were on NBC Sports, and then the last couple have been on just regular old NBC. And it's nice to see that the rest of the country is going to get to see this, which is why I hope that Nashville is able to pull it together and force this thing into a Game 7. Because seeing these two teams involved in a Game 7 against each other with a cup at stake in Pittsburgh, that's going to be a hell of a game.
And the other thing is I've noticed that with their backs against the wall, Nashville does seem to be able to respond.
Yep.
I have to give them credit. Now, at the same time, Pittsburgh has done the same thing. Certainly by taking, what was it, Washington to seven games, or was it Ottawa?
I was thinking it was Ottawa.
Okay. You know, their backs were definitely against the wall. But let's face it, you know, the Predators gave up the first goal in game three on their own home ice.
Right.
And then just came tearing right back. So all I can say is my hope is that when we next talk, since we still haven't crowned a Stanley Cup champion yet, the hope is that it will be the Nashville Predators.
Yeah, so we'll keep our fingers crossed on that one. And, of course, if you're listening to this and it's already happened, then you can either laugh at us or go, hey, they called it. John Grayson and Rob Ross, it is Radio City. And what have you been listening to? What's going on the CD player this week?
Well, as a matter of fact, I came home the other night and was very, very happy to find an envelope from the Concord Music Group, who are, of course, the distributors of Stax Records. And in that envelope happened to be a brand new CD, which I was able to actually remove from my Amazon orders since it was in this envelope.
Mm-hmm.
And it is The Best of Big Star.
Excellent.
For the first time, believe it or not, in the United States, an actual proper compilation of the what you would consider to be the best of Big Star. There have been several of these, and I actually have one of them from overseas, but I don't really rate them. Case in point is that they tend to use live tracks, et cetera, because they couldn't get the rights to the actual studio versions. Well, here they all are together. And I will admit, and by the way, this review will be up on Popdose. The album comes out this coming Friday, June 16th. The review will be up on Monday the 19th. I have my questions about certain tracks because obviously I'm going to nitpick, but I nitpick out of love. Nonetheless, the mastering or remastering on this is out of this world.
Great.
You know, Big Star is one of those bands that sound good. Their records were recorded in 1972 and 74, and they sound magnificent, as they were, because of the sheer genius of the late John Fry. But now Adam Hill, who is, you know, just an absolute master at Arden Studios, has remixed this to sound even more spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get to the meat of what's on the CD, which was what made it such a joy to drive around and listen to. The songs you expect to be on here are on here. When My Baby's Beside Me, In the Street, Feel, 13, Ballad of El Goodo, September Girls, Thank You, Friends. The thing is that on this CD, for the first time, you get the single mixes that are so long out of print, unavailable, and extremely rare. Most importantly is the particular single mix, single American mix of September Girls, which was, I've never actually physically seen a copy on Ardent. For a very brief time, Terry Manning, who was, of course, a close friend, confidant, and collaborator with Big Star and everybody at Arden, had a label in Memphis called Privilege Records.
Mm-hmm.
And actually issued September Girls on a 45. There was a different mix to this. It was a half-speed mastered faster. So it bounces along just a tiny, but you can hear the marked difference between the two mixes.
Yeah.
But you get the single mix of In the Street, you get the single edits of Jesus Christ and Oh My Soul. You get the single mixes of Watch the Sunrise and Don't Lie to Me. And like I said, I'm nitpicking here, but some of the songs that they used, I wouldn't have had on there to consider part of the best of. I wouldn't have put Take Care on this album. Take Care is off of Big Star Third. I would have rather had Big Black Car. I wouldn't have used I'm in Love with a Girl, which is from Radio City. I would have actually had Try Again from Number One Record. And I wouldn't have had Life is White off of Radio City. I would have rather have had Daisy Blaze, which is also off Radio City. Those songs seem to flow better and have much more balance. But that's just my nitpick. Nevertheless, if you've been racking your brain trying to think of a way to turn people on to Big Star or your kids or just friends, this is the perfect CD to get them started. You couldn't ask for a better choice. All you have to do is just say to somebody, here, finally have a proper The Best of Big Star. The liner notes were written by Robert Gordon, who, of course, is the noted Memphis music historian and writer, the author of Respect Yourself, The Story of Stax Records and the Soul Explosion, which was not only an incredible book, but that wonderful documentary.
Yeah.
The packaging is fantastic. It's tasteful, and everything about this is just right. So that, of course, was what was on the CD player this week. So that and a whole bunch of Paul McCartney things, because we'll get to that later. It was a pop dose topic.
Very good. And one of the things that is, it has arrived, and I have not yet had the chance to take it out of its package, but this is something that I'm sure we're going to talk about next week. Tomorrow morning, I'm having a conversation with Rich Robinson, ex of the Black Crowes, of course, and now he's put together a band that has, I think, a couple of the members of the Crowes in it, and they're called the Magpie Salute. They've been around for a little while now, and their new disc, I've got a bunch of copies of it that just arrived for the radio show for giveaways downstairs, and I'm looking forward to cracking one of those open, because I think as much of a distraction the fight between him and Chris was over the course of the Crowes, I always got the feeling that it was... Chris has been taken to task, I think, for being kind of spiky over time, but Rich seems like, you know, he gave as good as he got in a lot of those fights. But still, I think having the two of them apart gives them both the chance to expand and sort of, forgive the pun, but spread their wings as artists maybe, and not have to worry about the overarching row that was the driving force in a lot of ways behind the breakup of the Black Crowes.
Well, you know, the funny thing about the Crowes, and I am such a massive fan of that band, is, you know, I think if you talk to either one of them individually, they really do love each other a
sure.
great deal. They're not good in a band together, unfortunately. that happens. You know, Rich Robinson to me has always been the steady, solid one. You know, he's been the grounded one, whereas obviously Chris was the mouth and the so-called intellect and the face of the band, if you will.
Right.
And Rich was always his counterpoint foil, you know. And Rich is also one of the best and most criminally overlooked guitarists, bar none, in the United States. I mean, he's just such a fluid, solid player. And, you know, I don't think I can sing enough praises about the Black Crowes. And, yeah, you know, I've heard the name the Magpie Salute several times, obviously, since, you know, it has to do with Crowes yet again. I'm
right.
thinking Heckle and Heckle, obviously. But... kind of curious to hear what it sounds like. I can't see that it would be too far removed. If I'm not mistaken, I think Mark Ford, who played on at least three of the Crowes albums, is part of this band.
I think you're right,
Mark
yeah.
replaced Jeff Cease after Moneymaker. Mark Ford came in for Southern Harmony, was on Amorica, and then Three Snakes and a Charm. But, and God, he's a great guitar player himself, so... That kind of tandem just stands to reason that you're going to get something really good. And I think Sven Pippian might be back on bass. Don't quote me on that. But,
yeah.
You know, I really miss the Black Crowes, actually. I miss them a lot because, although I have to say, to me, the Black Crowes, and they had done this without him, the Black Crowes aren't the Crowes without Steve Gorman. Even though his last name isn't Robinson, he's a Robinson. And without that triad, you don't really have the Black Crowes. And, of course, now with Eddie Harsh gone, that band should never get back together. They should just stay a good memory from a very special time. But, yeah, look forward to hearing this record, too.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun to check out. So, and what I've been listening to most, really, over the course of this last week, again, is just listening back to that Blood Rush Hour CD, because it's so good. And I've grown a couple of favorite tracks off of that one. I mean, it's solid from beginning to end. This is the new one from them, and it's called Who Folds First. And the two that stick with me and that I find myself repeating over and over again is 6, 4, 5 and Sometimes 1 and Find Another Russian Dancer. I just love those two songs.
Well, you've been high on Find Another Russian Dancer from the moment
from
that
the
album
beginning.
Came out.
Yeah.
I mean, the great thing about any album by anybody is you get that one lock-in track
right.
that you immediately gravitate to, and then you kind of find your way around the rest of the album and everything. It's kind of like the magnet track of the album. It pulls the rest of your love for an album together. But, you know, it's funny because I was like that with a band that I hipped you to recently, a band called Dirty Looks.
Yes.
Who were from Staten Island. And Dirty Looks, I have to say this, is not to be confused with the other band, Dirty Looks, who were a hair metal band on Atlantic Records in the late 80s. The Dirty Looks I'm talking about was a trio from Staten Island. They were on Stiff Epic Records. They were a new wave power pop trio. It's kind of hard, and I'm glad that it is, to describe them accurately because they put out their debut self-titled album in 1980, and they were the culmination of The Jam and what soon became rockabilly revivalism without the obvious rockabilly overtones, and what later became the REM sound. Because the arpeggios that Patrick Barnes, who's the lead guitarist, does, you automatically hear Pete Buck the
yep.
minute you hear this. And this is a, you know, 2 full years before the first REM releases. But the thing about Dirty Looks is the fact that, of course, they never became famous. But to us, they were heroes because A, they were local. B, they had an album out. C, they were just that fucking good. And their first album, when I heard the album, the first track, They Got Me Covered, I wasn't sure what to make of it, to be honest with you, because it was just so bombastic and explosive out of the box. And
yeah.
when you hear, you can understand why, but then later on, you really do fall in love with the track. But there was a track, it's actually the second song on the album, and it was also a video clip, which you can find on YouTube, a song called Love Crimes, that just drew me in from the first riff and the first slam of the drums. Is absolutely amazing, you know, for a three-piece to sound so fat and rich without having to turn it all the way up, no pun intended, because I'll get to that in a moment, you know, and thrash the hell out of it. No, the finesse playing on this album is just, it can't be questioned. But Love Crimes was so catchy that, you know, once I locked into that song, I listened to the rest of the album, and then songs like Take a Life and Accept Me and Disappearing and 12 O'Clock High, just absolutely phenomenal. And they wound up putting out a second album that was only released by Stiff in England called Turn It Up. It didn't sound as great. It was actually produced by Nick Garvey of the Motors. And it sounds a little too dry for what Dirty Looks were about. But still, I think there are three of my favorite songs by them on that album, most notably Daddy's Gone, Living Alone, which to me is quintessential Dirty Looks sound,
yeah.
and Deceit. And, you know, this was a band that we loved so much that when 2 Minutes Hate started, one of the first things we learned how to cover was a song called Rosario's Ashes, which was the flip side of their debut single, Lie to Me. And it wasn't on either album. And here's where the story takes a bit of a nice turn. I was riding the ferry to school one day, and I spotted this fellow who looked an incredible... bore an incredible resemblance to the bass player, Marco Sin, whose real name was Mark Weissman. And I kept thinking to myself, Marco Sin wouldn't be riding the ferry. He's a rock star. Now, keep in mind, you know, I'm from Staten Island. You know, I'm all of 18 years old, and I was in my first full-fledged band, and I was completely awestruck by the concept of one of my favorite musicians would be on public transport with me. And I saw this fellow a couple of times coming and going, and there was this one Friday when I was on my way back from my morning bio lecture. This was my first semester in college. And I see this guy getting off the ferry. And even though I was absolutely terrified, I walked up to him and I said to him, "Excuse me, but are you Marco Sin from Dirty Looks?" And he looked really surprised and goes, "Yeah, I am." And he was as nice and as kind and as sweet as could be. And, you know, of course, I was a gushy fan. And I don't think he expected that. But when I tell you he could not have been lovelier, he gave me his number, said, let's get together, hang out, you know, which we did. We became friends. And sadly, we lost Marco just after my 30th birthday. And yeah, I still miss him to this day. And, Patrick Barnes dropped out of music after the breakup of Dirty Looks, and Peter Parker, who is the drummer and another incredibly lovely human being, he's carried on. He lives now out in Wisconsin, but he still plays, and I still hear from him every now and then. And funnily enough, when Stiff Records was revived, the biggest hue and cry, that phrase keeps coming up a lot lately, made to that label was, when are you going to release the Dirty Looks albums on CD? And that was the first release of the revived label because there was such a request and demand for them. So we finally have the two Dirty Looks albums on CD sounding remarkable. And, although we'll never see that band again, obviously, I just wanted to bring them into a more public forum because they still get overlooked. They are truly a cult like band. They were from Staten Island. Mostly we knew about them. When the first album came out, we went to Corvettes, and if you're not from the New York area, you probably don't know what Corvettes is, but it was a superstore, a genuinely superstore where they sold anything and everything, and they had a wonderful record department. And for this occasion, the entire back wall was just the Dirty Looks album and nothing else. And you could get it for $3.99. And of course, I bought like two copies of it. I bought the British version of it. And the last, I don't know what you want to call it. It was like one of the last Holy Grail albums that I was searching for years ago was in fact Turn It Up, because you could never find the damn thing. And I was getting two copies, a German pressing on pink marbled vinyl and the British pressing with the inner sleeve. But the fact is that Dirty Looks is a band, or a band that it's been 37 years since that first album. And that's one of those that just never gets old for me. And it was just time to really bring up their name again and talk about them.
I'm glad you did, and I'm glad you sent me some of the music as well, because the one song you picked out, Daddy's Gone, of what you sent me, is the one that I grabbed immediately and said, you know what, that's a hell of a tune. And the things that stood out are the fact that, like you said, the album's 30 years old, but it could have come out now. The production on it is so good that it doesn't sound antique-y. It doesn't sound like it's been sitting on the shelf for very long. And the other thing is, they are so tight. I mean, so just locked up tight, that they sound great. And the other thing is that they've got what I would describe as that late 70s or early 80s punk rock strut coming out of everything that they do. I mean, it just oozes through the music. And that song is, I think, exemplary of that. It has attitude in every pore.
I'm glad you said that, because what goes along with the attitude, though, is the skill.
Yes.
They didn't sound like they were amateurish and just learning their instruments. They were just that good as musicians, and the tightness. You hear those records, and I'm sure you're going to go back and listen to the first album in its entirety, and you'll understand exactly what I mean the minute "They Got Me Covered" comes exploding out of the speakers. But when you saw them live, they were equally tight.
Good.
That's the beauty of it. They didn't go out of tune. Pat's voice didn't waver. Pat could sing live. The harmonies were tight. I mean, you want to talk about explosive. Dirty Looks were it. I mean, Dirty Looks were truly. That's why, even though I prefer to be in a four-piece band, I can live with the three-piece concept, not because of the Jam or trios like that, but because of Dirty Looks, because Dirty Looks showed me how it could be done with, I dare I say it, maybe a little bit of less is more because of the refined playing of all three players. I mean, you want to talk about a watertight rhythm section. Marco and Peter were locked in, and I do mean locked in. And you put Pat's guitar playing around that, and Pat was just so good. And we're talking about a live show where there was these three guys, certainly Marco and Pat didn't just stand there at the front and play. I mean, they were all over the place, and I mean all over the place. They were an exciting live band to see, which is what you want. You know, you pay whatever few bucks you can to see a band, and you know, Dirty Looks, like I said, were the quintessential band, and they were ours.
Yeah.
And that's what makes them real, twice as special to me.
Well, thank you for sharing. And I know we've got some new music to talk over this week as well. What's crossed the desk that has impressed you?
Well, there's one brand new one from Gem Records, and Marty Scott, man, every time he puts out something since he revived the label, it's just winner after winner, you know? And that's not bullshit. It's just wonderful to see somebody take so much time with each release that he chooses to put out. And this new one is, this one's kind of special, again, because one of the members happens to be Paul McCartney's guitarist, Brian Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And his counterpart in this band is Oliver Lieber, who happens to be, and Oliver Lieber is the drummer, he happens to be the son of Jerry Lieber. And since we're going to probably have to do a little history lesson, that's as in Jerry Lieber of Lieber and Stoller, who wrote X amount of classic songs that we have been singing for the better part of 50 plus years.
Yeah, right. What wasn't Goffin and King was them.
Right. They were the forerunners to every songwriting, the hit songwriting duo, I should say. And they have this this young woman who's also a member of the band and a singer, and they're called the Bayonets. And I think of them as being the classic garage slash punk slash Detroit, even though they're not from Detroit, kind of band, that kind of loud, roaring, melodic, motoring, just in your face, balls out, sweaty, get drunk and fuck kind of good time rock and roll, the way God intended good old rock and roll to be. It is not easy to do, not in this day and age, without sounding forced, formulaic, contrived, precious, call it whatever you want. You know, Brian Ray is a veteran, and he's been around for quite a while. Never mind the fact that he plays with McCartney, but as a frontman, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, he's a guy who's got the chops and the talent.
Well, right, and not only that, Brian Ray, if you've seen McCartney live, if you pay attention to what's going on stage, because Brian Ray is his touring guitarist as well, they switch off instruments a lot during the course of a three-hour McCartney show, and when McCartney grabs the Les Paul and starts playing that lefty Les Paul on stage, it's Brian Ray who then takes over on the bass. And yep. If you want to talk about talent, for a multi-instrumentalist like that, for Paul McCartney to say, here, you play bass on this one, you better know what the fuck you're doing.
Well, right, because, you know, with the exception of John Entwistle, Paul McCartney is bar none the greatest rock bass player there is.
Yep.
And his bass lines, if you can play, I'm going to give a wide berth to anybody out there. If you can play at least three of McCartney's bass lines from any song of the Beatles canon, then you're onto something.
Yeah.
Because he's so good. He refined that instrument. You know, Entwistle took it to a completely different stratosphere because Entwistle was playing lead bass is what he was doing. But McCartney, what he did around Ringo's very simple but very eloquent drumming, all I have to say is this. You Won't See Me, The Word.
Right.
Paperback, especially The Word. Listen carefully, and I do mean carefully. Paperback Writer and Rain. Those four songs, you know the guy really knew that instrument in a way that no one else could think of how to really define that instrument.
Right. Yeah, he rode that line between melody and rhythm section better than anybody. And he was able to make the bass lines in those songs as important as any other element of the song, rather than just sitting there and staying on note and, you know, banging out a four beat.
Right. And the thing is, Brian Ray is playing his lines. And if you can play those lines, then obviously you've got the chops. But the thing is that he's just really talented. He's got a great voice. And once you hear these songs, you just can't but help but sit and listen to the entire record.
Mm-hmm.
From the minute you hear Like She Does, I mean, wow. That's just it's there's a wow factor involved with this record.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's and by the way, this is not their first album. This is actually a re-release, except now on an actual, dare I say, you know, known label, a known entity like Gem. But this album called Crash Boom Bang, which is actually, I think, very cute.
Yep.
This came out last year. And, you know, it's just got so much zest and life to it. I mean, I Feel Love is just this organ-driven piece, you know, like one of those psycho organ, you know, if you played Question Mark and the Mysterians at about 100 miles an hour, that's what you get, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I'm going to have to check all of this out. And again, you know, Gem Records just knocking it out of the park again.
There you go. Especially the main track that I want to point out is Vagabond Soul, because it's got a horn section and it's got these really great Steve Cropper kind of guitar figures.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're going into Stax kind of sound, circa 66, 67, and Steven Tyler. Yeah, that's Steven Tyler, mm-hmm. is on it.
Oh, that's cool.
You know? So, you know, this is what we're talking about. And I'm telling you right now, this is one of those albums not to be missed.
Right. And of course, Gem has their own place in Beatles history as well. But going back to the, going all the way back to the mid-70s, I think, with some of the imports that came through Gem. So nice to see that name coming back into the fore with some new music.
Every one of my import Beatle albums still has its sticker.
Yep.
Another great import from Gem.
I remember seeing that a lot. Yep.
Most importantly, John, were it not for Gem physically releasing, not just importing and distributing, but physically releasing American albums, the first American albums, I should say, by 999, Susie and the Banshees, The Cure, we wouldn't have known about these bands because my copy of Boys Don't Cry wasn't even an album. It was done by PVC, which, of course, was the offshoot label of Gem. Boys Don't Cry is the American permutation of the Three Imaginary Boys album, and I think a very much stronger record when you hear the original American pressing of it.
Yeah.
Because it has Boys Don't Cry, Jumping Someone Else's Train, World War, you know, songs that were not on the British album. And you know, my copy of Kaleidoscope and Juju by Susie and the Banshees are also on Gem. The 999 album, I think it was High Energy Plan, was the American version of an album called Separates. And again, I think it's a little bit better than the British version. You know, Gem slash PVC knew what they were doing. I mean, hell, if it wasn't for Gem, we wouldn't have had the Bongos Drums Along the Hudson. So I don't think I have to say anything more than that.
Right, right. Yeah, and in fact, my first, the first 10-inch EP that I ever had that was a Beatles 10-inch was a Gem import as well. So yeah, they were doing interesting things back in the vinyl days. And it's funny because a lot of the bands you just mentioned, there's a column on Pop Dose this week from Bo Dur who talked about a song in particular. And he did one of my favorite things. He went into this constant back and forth that now the internet has given a lot of juice to about what a song means. And I mean, I remember hearing all of the arguments and all of the musical theory guys going after each other about what Don McLean's American Pie was really about, you know, what the story was behind that song. And it's one of those things that unless you ask the guy, you're never going to piece together, but it makes for such great fodder for arguments. And Bo stepped right in it this week with Pretty in Pink.
Now, what I also love is the fact that he quickly preluded the whole thing by saying this is not the single version / soundtrack remake version for the movie,
right?
Which was just an off song, but the original, incredible for all time masterpiece. That's the opening track, well, in the American edition, the opening track off of the 1981 Psychedelic Furs album Talk Talk Talk, which I bought that album sight unseen because they were coming back to New York for that tour. I had seen them in the summer of 80 on the first album tour, so I was already smitten with this band. And the minute I got the album home and I heard that opening drum slam and then that wonderfully fuzzy guitar of Roger Morris being, you know, played over by John Ashton's melodic notes weaving in and out, and then the pure eloquence of Richard Butler's raspy Bowie slash Rottenesque vocal delivery, all I could think was, this band's got the fucking winner on their hands. And you know, I have loved that song. It's maybe the exception of Susan Strange. That's probably, you know, Pretty in Pink is probably my favorite first song. And it's a song that still makes me weep because it reminds me of my youth and a very good time. But, you know, I love the fact that Bo looked into it and, you know, he's got Butler's input on what the song actually means, you know, and, you know, Butler saying that he thought it was about, you know, it was like a metaphor for a girl being naked.
Yeah, and there was maybe some cross-dressing elements to it in one of the arguments. I mean, it was all kinds of crazy stuff.
But people also talk about cross-dressing elements in Arnold Lane, for fuck's sake. You know, maybe Arnold Lane was just a panty sniffer and a thief. Maybe he wasn't wearing the shit himself. I don't know.
Right.
You know, I would ask Syd Barrett, but God rest his soul, he's not with us anymore, and he probably wouldn't remember or give a fuck. Because here's the thing, and this is the beautiful thing about a column like this. At the end of the day, whatever the song means to you is really what the song means.
Right, right.
Are you looking for a literal interpretation? Because, look, people have asked me, and I'm nobody, but people have asked me, well, what did the Wildflowers mean when I wrote that? Or what did Train of Thought mean when I wrote that? Now, Train of Thought, I can actually tell you exactly what I meant verbatim because that song genuinely has a story. And that's the differentiation between writing a song for the sake of writing a song like the Wildflowers versus writing what I consider a real song, which is I have an idea about something and I'm thinking about something very specific. But again, however you see fit to interpret it is all that matters. Did you get something from the song? Does it mean something to you? If it does, then great. I'm not going to puncture your myth, and I'm going to tell you something. The Beatles are the ones who ruined it for me when I was 13 years old by having done that, by having punctured the myth, because I, like everybody else, believed because I wanted to believe that these songs had meaning to them. And I'll never forget when they were – it's in Hunter Davies' only authorized biography about the Beatles as they were working on Pepper. And I think you and I covered this, but or talked about it. You know, they were sitting down just shouting any old thing while they're writing a song. And at the end, Lennon says, if we told you that when we wrote She's Leaving Home, we were thinking about a bunch of bananas, you wouldn't want to believe it. People want to be conned. And that just ruined it for me.
Yeah.
Because you're saying, then we're a bunch of idiots for taking these songs to heart. You know, do I honestly have a clue as to what any REM song means? Not one. Do I care? No.
No. Yeah.
You know? Because Mike Mills even said, you know, because during The One I Love, he always thought it was very funny that, you know, guys would kiss their girlfriend and put their arms around them and cuddle them. And, you know, it's so sweet. And he said, yeah, you don't seem to understand. This is actually a very cruel and cold breakup song. And when you think about it in that context, you can see it, you know, a simple prop to occupy my time. You know, yeah, this one goes out to the one I love.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I get that. I get that now. Does it mean anything to me? No, because I can't stand the fucking song no matter how you like it. But,
yeah,
you know, Pretty in Pink, to me, when I read the lyrics, it seemed to me that Caroline was but a loose girl.
Yeah, and that makes as much sense as anything. But, you know, I think that if you ask any of the artists on any of these songs that we're talking about, they'll say exactly what you said at the open, which is it means exactly what it means to the person who's listening to it. And if you told them, look, this is what I got out of your song, they'd probably say, hey, that's great.
And if you can say it in an eloquent and semi-poetic way without sounding pretentious and incredibly cloying, then you just might make them feel good, knowing that, okay, I've done something that really lasts with you and it made you think. And I think that's what any artist really wants, is to be able to have a conversation about one of their works where it's a conversation about what the various avenues of interpretation could be. Listen, The Wildflowers, which I wrote in 1986 on my lunch break at work, was no more nor less than a vague thought of this girl in one of my classes who I, for all intents and purposes, wanted to...
nail?
Sure, yeah. And you know, I didn't want my girlfriend to know about it. So it was written in a very gobbledygook kind of way, you know? But everybody read the lyrics and go, oh, this is his sojourn into introspection and psychedelia. I'm like, no, it's psychedelic bullshit is what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
That's funny. Well, yeah. And, and a lot of those songs are written in that same fashion. And it's just, you know, it was something that sounded good. And there's a lot to be said for that, by the way. That there are words that just, in the course of writing a song, sound good next to each other. I had a conversation years ago about a song that I had a feeling was autobiographical. That, you know, it was one of those things that actually happened, like Gimme Three Steps was a real story. And this was with Roger Klein from the Peacemakers. And I asked him about a particular incident. And he said, well, yeah, that really happened. He said, I changed a couple of things. He said, it happened at a bar in Nashville, but I changed it to Memphis because Memphis just sounded better in the context of that song. You know, just the word itself sounded better next to those other words. And that's an important thing as a songwriter as anything, you know. Why, that's what poetic license is all about. You know, why be truthful when it just sounds good?
Absolutely, going along with that, not just what sounds good, you know, just for the sake of creative license, but you know, even if it sounds like a nonsense word, the use of alliteration, as long as it helps the song and the lyrical content flow,
right,
you can use that as well. You know, it's all about what you can do to make the song sound as good and make it come to life the way that you hopefully envisioned it in your mind. There's nothing more disappointing than hearing a song in your head and it just doesn't translate when all was said and done. You know,
yep.
I mean, you know, people ask for specific reference points in train of thought. And that is a real song because, you know, the thing that nobody seemed to pick up on was that was a genuine love song. And it wasn't to a woman. It was to my home of Staten Island, because it's a song about home, memory, time, and history.
Right.
And all it was me truly connecting the dots. But when you're able to have a conversation of meaning behind it, because what they think it means, that just makes you feel so incredibly good. It's not an ego stroke, but it's the fact that you've done something that actually has some relevance, that somebody actually cared enough to sit down, listen to, and for all intents and purposes, dissect while enjoying it.
Yeah.
And that meant that much to them that they wanted to ask you about it.
Yep, indeed. And I'll leave you with this, but in this part of the conversation, is the song Badge. By Cream was a co-write between, of course, George Harrison and Eric Clapton. And the two of them were sitting there, and there's two stories about that song that I think are fascinating and kind of cut to the heart of all of this. The first is, yeah, right, the bridge, which is what George Harrison had written over the bridge in the song, and it was misinterpreted by Clapton as Badge. So that's where the name came from. And this myth grew up about how it was George Harrison demanding his MBE from the Queen or something like that. And he said, no, it wasn't any of that. It was a misread word on the page. But the other one, and this is my favorite one, and it goes back to what you were just talking about words that sound good next to each other, is the line in the song, "Then I told you about our kid, now he's married to Mabel." That was the only line in that entire song that wasn't written by either Clapton or Harrison, because they were at Clapton's house writing the song, and they're going through it, and they kept humming over that line. And there was one other guy there who said, "Why don't you write something over that?" And they said, "We can't figure out something that sounds good." And Ringo Starr piped in, "Now I told you about our kid, and now he's married to Mabel." And, you know, it worked because it rhymed and it sounded kind of funny. And they said, "Okay, that's what it is." And they left it in.
Well, then it's very unfair that the credit doesn't read Harrison, Clapton, and Starkey.
And Starkey, right, it should.
Because If you remember the one of the worst songs that the Beatles ever did, What Goes On, the thankfully forgotten, oft forgotten What Goes On, credited to Lennon, McCartney, Starkey.
Right.
Being a successful songwriter, I'm not talking about making money. I mean, it's always nice, certainly, for someone who writes really good songs to be able to make money. But being a successful songwriter and having somebody 37 years after the fact, 36 years after the fact, ask you about what does the song mean? Here's my interpretation, and you have a dialogue with them about it, I think is fantastic.
Yeah.
I love the fact that Richard Butler is kind enough to take the time to actually talk to someone about a song that I'm sure he's been inundated with questions about for a million years at this point. But Pretty in Pink, you know, that was a song that you could sit down and really chew on and mull over what the words could mean.
Right.
And I always would say could mean, because there are a lot of songs out there like what are the lyrics to The Bitterest Pill by The Jam really about? You know what? I don't give a shit. You know, it's a good song. It's a weeper, but it's a good song. Do I care what Elvis Costello is writing about? No, I don't.
Right. Well, I finally got the opportunity a couple of months ago to ask a member of the band America what the fuck alligator lizards in the air means. And it wasn't, you know, the fact is it's not really a great story, but it's one of those lines I heard since I was a little kid and went, alligator lizards in the air? What the hell is that? So turns out it's just cloud formations. Dude was a reptile expert and he liked looking at clouds.
You know what I say to that? Life in the fast lane.
There you go. Right. Same deal. It's crazy. But I know before we get to In Our Heads, we've got a couple more things to talk over, one of which is another new artist that you profiled this week on Pop Dose. Tell us a little bit about Amy Black.
She's apparently been around for a while, but ooh, what a voice. Let's just start with that. Just, ooh, what a voice. I mean, that's the kind of voice that just gives you goosebumps.
Yeah.
From the moment she opens her mouth. She's actually playing New York in a fairly short amount of time. I'm hoping to catch her live to see if she's got the chops in concert. But she put out a new album called Memphis. So, of course, naturally, it piqued my interest.
Sure.
The thing was, you know, she had been wanting for a while to do an album made of Memphis classics or Memphis style recorded in Memphis. So this was a labor of love. Let's start with that. There was nothing twee about this. And then some of the players that she got to work with her. Bobby Manuel, who was very young when he started working and playing guitar at Stax Records,
mm-hmm.
plays on this album. From High Records, Howard Grimes, the drummer on all those sessions for Al Green and Ann Peebles,
yeah.
and you know, one of Will Mitchell's henchmen. Reverend Charles Hodges playing keyboards, and his brother Flick Hodges playing bass. Scott and Bomar of the more modern band The Bow Keys was the producer, and Adam Hill from Arden mixed this. So
that's a hell of a group.
That is, yeah, you've got basically every one of your bases completely covered in the right way. And this record really does have it. I mean, she obviously had a very specific sound and range in mind, a very specific time period, that 71, 2, 3, 4 period of what came out on High, and definitely what was coming out on Stax. It's hard to love an angry man, which is just such a wow. That's a wow track.
Mm-hmm.
You immediately think of High Records. You could hear Ann Peebles singing this,
yeah.
no question. Imagine, if you will, the first time you heard Joss Stone.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing.
Right.
Even when Joss Stone put out the Soul Sessions, all bets were off because nobody could touch that voice. That girl was an unbelievable breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, she actually covers an old Otis Clay song, If I Could Reach Out and Help Somebody. You want to talk about having your heartstrings pulled to the point of actual tears. I mean, You know, it's a heartbreaker. It you want to talk about soul? This song has it. Her voice conveys it immeasurably.
Yeah. Well, and where they recorded this, too, I think is interesting because you've got on the page the primer for the album. It's sort of a setup video, and it looks like they're in a house. In fact, they may very well be because they're all kind of jammed into one room playing together. And first of all, I love the fact that they're all playing together, you know, that it's not here. You record this track and we'll layer it in on top. They recorded it as a band. But the fact that it's in a setting like that, I think, is cool, too. It adds nobody else is going to be able to replicate exactly what they had going on in the sound of that track.
Well, the thing is that was part of the idea, was to have them playing as a formed unit.
Yep.
To get the feel, to get the essence of the soul of the songs down, never mind the soul of the performance or the soul of the atmosphere. When you're a band, and I'm using the term loosely because, you know, it's an aggregate, obviously, of new musicians brought together for these sessions, but when you're playing together in formation, it just brings life that you really can't convey that when, okay, you're going to go in and put down the bass track and I'll go in and put down the guitar and he'll go in and put down the drums. It just doesn't work that way, and then layering on the vocals. When you play together, it's organic, and organic trumps everything every time.
Right.
It's always the one. But I mean, you listen to this record and as it goes along, it takes along meaty selections of what that whole period and feeling was like. I mean, there's a track called, oddly enough, 19, which has acoustic guitar strings in it and a Booker T definite styled organ riff, you know? And We Got a Good Thing definitely walks right out of the Stax Studios around 72, around the time that the Staples were doing the album Beatitude, which had Respect Yourself. Although that was actually recorded at Ardent.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, it's still that whole, she nailed down a very specific period and hit the marks each time.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's got a terrific feel to it. And you can tell, again, these are musicians that know each other, like each other. And she's just got that voice over top of it that draws the whole thing together. So definitely want to check out. And before we get to the In Our Head segment, anything else has been rolling through yours this week?
Well, there is one thing we need to bring up, and that is two more folks from the acting world have left us.
Yeah.
Glenn Headley, who was, in many ways, most well-known as being John Malkovich's first wife and a very fine actress, passed away suddenly on Friday. And yesterday we got the sad news that we have lost the one and only Batman and the mayor of Quahog, Mr. Adam West.
He was both of those things. And Adam West, with the work that he did, certainly on Batman and everything else, all of the voiceover work that he did over the years, even going back to right after, there's always an MST3K connection, right after I had discovered Mystery Science Theater, I guess this would have been about 94 or 95, was when they did the first Turkey Day marathon. And Comedy Central, back at that point, was running the show, and they did 24 hours of nothing but Mystery Science Theater episodes. And in the interstices in between, Adam West came out, and they shot these things where he was ostensibly preparing the turkey dinner. And it was hilarious. It was brilliant and funny. And again, it had that kind of loose, hey, we're all just kicking back and having a good time, and it's Thanksgiving and everybody's happy kind of feel to it. But just hearing that voice again, and it had been a while at that point since I'd heard him doing very much, it was like a warm bath, man. I just felt like, you know what? I'm a kid again, and I hear Adam West's voice, and everything is okay.
You know, the thing is, even though he had a lot of trouble, and he was one of those who fought the whole pain of, you know, being typecast into roles.
Sure.
He seemed to have a very good sense of humor about it. And he seemed to go about it with, okay, I at least I keep trying.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't turn into, God help us, George Reeves.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Of course, there is question about whether or not that was murder or if it was suicide. But still, Adam West was a guy who just kept on working and, you know, didn't seem to resent being Batman in the end. You know, it's kind of like the antithesis of it. Finally took Michael Nesmith a very long time to understand and accept the fact that he's very loved and appreciated as being Mike Nesmith of the Monkees.
Right.
You know?
Well, yeah, and then there was something, I wonder what's going to happen now, because I had a conversation about a month ago with Burt Ward, who, of course, was Robin on the original TV series, and he mentioned at the time that the animated Batman that came out a year or two ago, that used all of the original characters, all of the living characters from the original Batman TV series were involved in that, including Adam West. And I think Julie Newmar was in it and a whole bunch of others, that they were, that was so successful that they were going to do another one. And I think they were set to do all of the voice work over this summer. So now with Adam West gone, I wonder if they're going to just get a replacement for him, if they're going to get a sound alike or what they're going to do there. But I guess we'll find out within the next year or so.
Yeah, but, you know, and granted, he was what?
88.
How old? 88. I mean, he had a good long life. So
yep.
God bless.
And by the way, before we leave Glenn Headley, the one thing that, I mean, she did so much work. She was great as a sort of a drop-in character in movies. But the one that she did that I think was, it was such a fantastic movie because everybody involved in it did such a great job with it, was Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. I knew you were going to say it. I knew it.
Just,
she's also adorable.
Yeah, she, know? And in that movie especially, I mean, she just had that girl next door kind of, you know, that girl that was in your history class that you always mooned over and never bothered to ask out.
And then probably you found out that she was kind of a what do you call it, a sickie. In the end, you would have loved to have actually, had you asked her out, you know, she would have fulfilled all your fantasies. She was kind of the dirty librarian.
Exactly, right, and then some. So, yeah, it was a sad loss with her as well. And she was young. I think pulmonary embolism, I think, is what they said for cause of death on her.
Jesus, because when I read the news, they did not have a clear answer as to what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the early word. But yeah, that's another thing that, I mean, that has taken so many great people away from us. And unfortunately, it's one of those things that's very difficult. You could go your entire life never knowing you had a problem and then be gone in an hour.
Yeah.
So,
that's sadly true. So, okay. And now, without any further ado, delay, adieu, or interruption, you know, we're very pleased to present to you this week's segment, In Our Heads.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that it goes back to something that, curiously enough, came up earlier in this conversation, because my vote for In Our Heads this week goes right to the Beatles, and it goes back to, we were talking all about the genius of Paul McCartney and how he was able to make the bass guitar do things that other people had not done up until that point. But what I love about listening to their music is that no matter how many times you've heard a song, especially if it's one that you've heard forever, you tend to think of them as an entity. And you talked about listening back to songs, especially from that sort of Revolver, Rubber Soul era, and listening intently to what McCartney was doing on the bass. But the one that hit me this week wasn't Paul. And I don't know how many times over the course of my life I've heard Get Back. It's got to be 1,000+. And yet this week when I heard it, for some reason, George Harrison's lead guitar stuck out to me. And I started listening back to it, and then I replayed the song and listened back to it again, and then I replayed it again and got even more involved in paying attention to what he was doing with the lead guitar in that song. And you know what? It's amazing. I mean, it's not terribly intricate. You know, it's not one of those things where you're going to break your fingers trying to learn how to do it. But holy shit, I mean, it was more than most people would do, and it fit that song like a glove. And that's part of why that song so easily melts into a complete entity, is that all of the individual playing on it fits together so perfectly. You know, it's like a puzzle. And then when you finally put the thing together, you see the bridge. But you know, in each individual piece, there's a lot of magic there. So I would encourage you, no matter how much you think you know about that song or how many times you think you've heard every little thing in it, go back and listen to George's work on that song. It's really something special.
Well, one, that song to me is like the Beatles doing a sophisticated kind of R&B sound.
Yep.
They're getting soulful. And it's Silk. That's how I've always felt about that song. It's like Silk.
Yes.
The playing by Harrison and Lennon's, you know, riff underneath is just so smooth and so naturally interwoven. And like you said, it doesn't have to be intricate, but it's tasteful.
Right.
And it works. And it works for the song. And you notice McCartney's bass line isn't anything special. It's Ringo's propulsive drumming that carries it along with the Fender Rhodes by Billy Preston. That whole performance is just that. It's a whole performance, which if you think about it, when was the last time you heard the Beatles give you a full performance of that ilk? You know, probably since Revolver.
Yeah, 66.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, having, you know, broken down Get Up and Go, and by the way, dig it up on YouTube. You'll find George singing Get Back.
Oh, really?
Or Stig's Get Up and Go, whichever version you prefer to interpret as. You know, we're not going to escape this conversation without getting thrown in there somehow. If I was going to go back and really revisit, well, I've done this before, which is why we're able to talk about this with such ease, mm-hmm. if you will, and we don't have to think about it too much. That it's the little intricate details that you pick up on with the Beatles, tiny little nuances, and I mean really tiny nuances. Case in point, at the very, very end of "And Your Bird Can Sing,"
yeah,
as the bass line's fading out, you hear one of either George or John taking his fingers off the guitar strings, and you hear the two notes just fit right in at the very end. I don't think it was meant to be played, but you pick up on it. And suddenly when you're playing the song and you're playing guitar, at the very end, you wait for that doo-doom, 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 and that's when you go,
right,
directly or otherwise.
Yep.
You know, the same thing goes with Norwegian Wood. It's very subtle, and you really have to be paying attention for it. There's one extra McCartney note on the bass, which is a very simple bass line. And there's also a kind of a, I think, an accidental tweak of the sitar that you barely notice, but it sweetens it. There's just something right about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back and listening to something and taking apart and listening to it in a way that you really hadn't perceived of it before. The last time I did that with a Beatles track was actually one of my favorite songs off of Revolver, and that's I Want to Tell You, George Harrison track, because I wanted to record it. That was one of the few songs early on that I learned McCartney's bass line. It's not difficult, but it's very solid. And you have to play it on point to make sure that it works in the whole context of the song.
Yeah.
And just the little nuances between the guitar riff and the seventh chords on the keyboards, to which I am not a very good keyboard player. I never have been. But to be able to pick out all the little parts and hear them kind of locked in with each other, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it makes the song even more of an experience. And the fact that this song is so, you know, it's forgotten in the mix because it's sandwiched in between Dr. Robert and Got to Get You Into My Life. You know, that's one of those songs that you need to go back and revisit. There's nothing fancy about it, but there's so much life in the song. And then the vocal harmonies, especially at the end where the recurring line of I've Got Time and McCartney just starts climbing with his voice at the end, which, you know, to me, that's Paul showing off and being Paul.
Yeah, right.
But it's a device that worked really well on another song by a band you and I both love, and that is the ending of The Door into Summer,
yep.
off of Pisces Capricorn. The Monkees replicated that ending to a T, but what they did was a very interesting little song cycle where vocal cycle where Mickey is singing around Mike's harmony, I think with Peter, or maybe it was an extra vocal of Mickey's overlapping his own harmony with Mike, because it was usually Mike and Mickey doing the harmonies. That ending so enthralled me that I wrote a song that actually appears on the Punchline album, To Get to the Other Side, a song called Someone, which, first of all, and I will confess this because I have nothing to hide, is my very weird attempt to mash together Pleasant Valley Sunday and I Want to Tell You, because when you hear the guitar riff, it's both those riffs backwards, essentially. But it also throws in the kind of oohs and ahs that Townsend and Entwistle would do in the middle part that breaks and then before the riff comes back in. But at the very end, and this is the most important thing, at the very end, I did exactly that bit that McCartney does in I Want to Tell You. But more importantly, I really went for the Dolan's Nesmith. What I call the vocal cycle around each other. Now, the way I went about having us do it was I sang the melody line, and then I sang my own harmony over it, but not directly with it in sync of a harmony. So it's cycling around it. And then I had our drummer, Chris, shout harmonize the last bit. So it's a non-stitched harmonic cycle.
You mentioned the oohs and ahs, and that's another thing that comes up to me every time I listen back to one particular Beatle track, because I remember watching The Complete Beatles, the documentary that came out, I think mid-80s, and they were talking to McCartney one time about what it meant to be a collaborator with Lennon. And he said, well, it's like this. He mentioned that when he was writing Getting Better, that line just kind of, he would play through it and sing it, and when he got to the end of the first line of the chorus, that's when Lennon would throw things in, couldn't get much worse. And it was just kind of a natural thing that flowed out of them. But my favorite one has always been in You Won't See Me, when it gets to the no, I wouldn't, no, I wouldn't. I mean, the way that they end that line in that chorus or in that bridge is just so cool. And it's something that they could have just kept going ooh and ah, but it gives it a little bit of extra something. And that's what you always got out of the Beatles tracks, was just a little bit more.
Well, funny thing about You Won't See Me is that song has a very special place in my heart. And I've actually recorded two versions of it.
Mm-hmm.
One while incredibly inebriated. I drank a bottle of Chianti and then attempted to record it because I'd figured out the bass line. Now, how you figure out a McCartney bass line in a drunken stupor is beyond my comprehension, but yeah. I did. And it turned out really good. Then a couple of years later, I did it again. Only it sounds more like Michael Stipe fronting the Beatles, you know? But always doing those, no, I wouldn't, no, I wouldn't, which if you listen to the no, I wouldn't, no, I wouldn't at the end of the eighths, those aren't in harmony. They're right. Actually just sung as melody. And then there's one variation of harmony the first time they do it after the no, I wouldn't, no, I wouldn't. And then on the last verse, when if you notice the song actually slows down in tempo.
Right.
On the last verse. That's when Lennon and Harrison, I'm presuming, are singing the ooze
yep.
in harmony. I mean, that's where the Beatles showed their true genius. Do it one way on one part, do it a completely different way on the next part.
Right.
You know, they always had those little, I always thought they weren't even pre-planned. They were just, it was the way it came out. It was the spontaneity of it, the natural ability of this band. Because they worked so well together.
Yeah.
You know? And I got to tell you, if you haven't read it, or if you have, go back and reread it, especially the chapter on songwriting. The Hunter Davies biography gives us so much to work with and talk about from, because just the way they went about doing it, it wasn't a very workman-like way. You know, one of them sitting at a piano, the other one with a pen, and just kind of shouting things and ideas and, all right, I've got this idea. What can we do with it? And you try and find your way around it, like trying to write the words for With a Little Help from My Friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was something of an arduous task, you know, and you actually are reading the development of the lyrics that you know so well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And again, you know, it's all that behind the music stuff. It's the craft of songwriting that I think is just the interesting part about it. I mean, that's the magic behind it all. So, I will definitely check that out. And in the meantime, Rob Ross, we've got a whole bunch more going on elsewhere on Pop Dose, as always. And I want to encourage people to go see that because there's always something there for you on the page. In addition to some terrific writing, you'll find some clickable music or a video or two to watch. And it's always worthwhile to do that. Great job again, my friend. And we'll look forward to talking some more next week.
As always, John, a pleasure. Have a great week. Stay well, and I will talk to you very soon.
It is Radio City, and there's more of it coming up next time around. So join us then on popdose.com.